ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, text 26, canto 5, chapter 19, the island of Jambudvip. In India, Bhart Varsha, there are many worshippers of the demigods, the various officials appointed by the Supreme Lord, such as Indra, Chandra, and Surya, all of whom are worshipped differently. The worshippers offer the demigods their oblations, considering the demigods part and parcel of the whole, the Supreme Lord. Therefore, the Supreme Personality of Godhead accepts these offerings and gradually raises the worshippers to the real standard of devotional service by fulfilling their desires and aspirations. Because the Lord is complete, He offers the worshippers the benedictions they desire, even if they worship only part of His transcendental body. So the worship of devas, devatas, used to also be all over the world. It's gone out of fashion almost everywhere, except still in India that's happening. But people all over, we know in Europe, Greek mythology, Roman mythology, Norse mythology, it's all called mythology. The stories of the devatas, and these are actually all derived from the original Sanskrit Vedic gods. Zeus is Indra, who's the same as Jupiter. Jupiter is just a Latinized version of the Greek Zeus Pitar, God the Father. Zeus Pitar, Jupiter. And that's originally Indra, same functions. So, similarly, in various Norse mythology, Germanic, Scandinavian gods, you can all trace them back historically to the Vedic deities, because these were originally the tribes of Kshatriyas who populate Europe. Later they were expelled into the hinterlands by Parashurama. So as they were Kshatriyas, and as they had deviated, and as they had no proper Brahminical guidance, naturally in the course of time, these stories became distorted, so there's many differences. Anyway, the system is there all over. Now, of course, here we are always preaching about people about not to worship the demigods, a lot of times you also have to simultaneously teach people that yes, the demigods exist, but don't worship them. Because they don't, this idea of demigods is out of favor. You know, hard enough to believe in God, but also there's this vast heavenly bureaucracy that Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, all the Vedic literature tells us about this bureaucracy. Of course, the thing we have to understand is why Prabhupada always uses this word demigod for them.
that they are jivas.
When Christianity and Islam spread, people were worshipping demigods all over the place. There's always a system, even if they weren't Vedic names, still they were worshipping. So Christianity, Islam preached about one supreme God and asked people not to worship these demigods that they were locally engaged in worshipping like we do. And actually, early Christians, their version of what demigod worship was, like the Greek and Roman gods, was that actually they didn't say that they didn't exist. They just said they were demons. They said there are various demons that had deluded people into worshiping them. There's all kinds of stories in early Christian literature of somebody exorcising a demon from someone who was possessed, and the demon speaks out of the person's voice and announces that, yes, I'm Apollo being worshipped over here at this temple. So we still run into this today, fundamentalist Christian account of other religions is that everybody's worshiping the devil or demons like that. So anyway, nowadays, in the course of time, it came to be these various kinds of forces or personalities came to be discredited. People still believed in one God, but not in this whole lower level hierarchy, and mostly driven out by the idea of science. Science needs a universe where there aren't any. See, the idea of that there are people running things in the universe that stands in the way of scientific control. If you have this idea that there's some person in charge of rain, for example, then you can't. The idea of science is that you can describe everything in terms of mathematics. The whole universe can be quantified. And ultimately, its operations all described in terms of mathematics. And then you can get a kind of grip on it. What is what meant by mechanistic science. So, but if in your formula, say you want to represent, like they now, they would love to be able to create a computer model of the weather system. To be able to predict what the weather is going to be, right? That's very useful to know what the weather is going to be. So they create computer models to try to, you type in all the conditions and you ought to be able to predict it. It turns out, of course, by the way, that it's very complicated, and there's what they call the butterfly effect, that apparently the breeze made by the flutterings of a butterfly fly wing can actually have multiple effects. This looks difficult. Anyway, that's their hope. You know, this is the vision that you could get as all mathematics, a computer model. And you could not only predict the weather, but you could know that right here, you know, if we make this little change right here, then we can, you know, bring the rain over here and stop the storm and, you know, control the weather. So, but if there is a bureaucrat up there, what is he, officials appointed by the Supreme Lord, who's in control of the weather, then how do you put that in your equation?
What do you do with it? So therefore, the idea that there's a person up there in control of the thing has simply been decided that's ancient, ignorant superstition. And we'll get rid of that idea. Anyway, who's seen him? You see the pictures, haven't you? There's the storm clouds in the middle. There's an elephant, and Indra's on that elephant riding the storms, hurtling his thunderbolts, which are lightning. So we go over the clouds all the time. We go up to 30,000 feet, look down the clouds. Nobody's seen that elephant. The man on the elephant, where is he? You know. So you don't see them. So people don't believe in this idea. So this is all part of the process of the German sociologist Max Weber called it disenchantment. Disenchantment. The disenchantment of the universe. Or you could say making it impersonal. Because people used to, everywhere, this idea was there, all over the human race. I mean, China, Ireland, everywhere you go, there is this notion that for every grove of trees, every stream, every mountain, there is a person who is a guardian of that stream, mountain, river, grove of trees. A little person you couldn't really see. Everywhere, people encounter these people, these personalities, and all part of a system. Now, that's not there. They're just these mechanistic forces of nature. So there's it's been a change in consciousness to this impersonal idea of a universe. They depersonalized the universe. Now, of course, they've depersonalized God. We're busy depersonalizing each other. You know, just to get this whole vision of a complete cosmos that's just a whole structure of machines, you know. That's this idea of artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence means this is going on places like MIT, Carnegie Mellon, that they'll be able to make a machine like a robot that if you meet him and talk to him, you won't be able to tell it's a machine. It'll be so cleverly programmed that in every respect, it'll be a human being. And if you punch him, he'll go, ouch, you know? And you won't be able to tell. And the motive behind this is, having done that, that all you really have is there's no soul, there's no mind, even. There's simply silicon. Little bits of silicon, cleverly put together, and little switches going on and off in simple order. They're going to say, since it acts like a person, walks like a person, talks like a person, responds like a person, and everybody else accepts it as a person, it is a person. And therefore, because it's only made out of silicon chips, there's no soul or anything like that, it's all just simply, everything's completely matter operating under mathematical laws, that's all that we are too. We're just simply another kind of naturally produced robot. Anyway, this is the fantasy. They haven't come anywhere near close, but you know how it is. They're already, you know, writing as if it's happened. Or they're on the verge of it, or so on like that. And they do have little programs. Sometimes people deal with computers. They don't realize they're dealing with computers. Which only goes to show how little alert people are, you know. They're like robots themselves. So anyway, this idea, these demigods are there, Indra, Chandra, Surya, this information comes to us from olden times. And it was the common experience of the human race to encounter not only Indra, Chandra, Surya, but nymphs and local water spirits and sprites and fairies and leprechauns and, you know, all over the place. Everybody saw them. Everybody talked to them. Now, we want to say that somehow people in those days were all of them totally deluded. But why couldn't it be the other way around? Why aren't we totally deluded? And we don't look for these people. We don't want to see them. They don't want to deal with us. There's some grove of trees. I mean, what's our attitude toward this grove of trees? We have no particular personal affection for a grove of trees. You know, we wouldn't hesitate to take a bulldozer and just run right through it. It's just a thing to be missed. So you know, we're our mentality is so different that you can't see, because what you see, what you can perceive depends on your intelligence. And if your intelligence is set in a certain way, you won't see things. When people discover things that are right before their eyes, they don't see them because they don't look for them. And only when somebody points it out, there it is, then they see, oh, I didn't notice. Just like you can look at a picture, you know, like the famous thing right now is this Batman logo, you know. It's a typical thing, you know. Looks like you see two lobes coming down and three lobes coming up. A lot of people see it. It looks like some kind of rounded teeth. And that's what they'll see until somebody comes and say, no, see, look at it the other way. See, the metal part is the background, and on there you see a bat wing. Oh, now I see it. And somebody points them out to them. Otherwise, they'll stare and stare and never see it. You know? Because it's the way perception works. Because it's controlled by intelligence, what you see, what you don't see. So anyway, what we're claiming is that all these demigods are there, along with all kinds of other things, and the fact that they're not visible now is simply a function of our misperception. And that actually, at one time, that this time, you know, the what they call the age of myth, they talk about that. There was the age of myth all over, you know. These stories of people dealing with these gods, demigods. And then all of a sudden, you know, that age of myth ends and there's no more stories like that. So why should this one be, this age be actually we're dealing with reality and those people were dealing with unreality? It could be the other way around. In fact, our claim is it is the other way around. That we accept these old stories as true. One problem is, of course, is that the old stories, they aren't consistent. They're so different from culture to culture to culture. Whereas, you know, science is one thing. But we can account for all those differences. What we say is here's the Srimad Bhagavatam is the deliberate attempt to preserve the ancient culture, passed down carefully through generations of qualified brahmanas who are trained to pass it down. Whereas, you know, in these other cases, it's just rumors, half-distorted memories, unscientific. Knowledge depends upon goodness. Here we see Bhagavatam sets the standard of the proper cultivation of the mode of goodness. Or actually, it's beyond that. It's those who are nirmatsaranam satam, transcendental to the modes. Those people can actually pass down the truth. Otherwise, there's going to be distortions in the field of knowledge caused by passion and ignorance and so on. So because of those distortions, you get many of it different kinds of versions of things. Anyway, but now all over, I was looking at a book the other day called The Reenchantment of the World. There's also, even outside of, people want to think that now there was some superior, that idea is coming current, at least in some circles. But people still have to come to the authorized version of this. So anyway, so this is characteristic. People are worshipping these demigods. So this, of course, causes some confusion. So Krishna discusses in the Bhagavad Gita the system of demigod worship. And he says they're actually worshipping me, but avidhi purvakam. Avidhi means not according to the proper way. They're Krishna's bodily parts, the demigods. And it's a fact that all the names of the demigods, like Indra, Chandra, Surya, are names of Krishna. That's actually stated in the Vedanta Sutra. The names of the demigods are the names of Krishna. So when you say Agni, Indra, Chandra, if you're ignorant, you're thinking you're naming some particular demigod. But if you actually know what's what, you actually are naming Krishna. Prabhupada confirms this when he was initiating, heard a tape of initiation in England, where a devotee was being named Rabindra, which means Ravi is the name of the sun, the, you know, Surya. So the sun globe is Ravi, and Indra means king, so king of the sun. So Prabhupada said, your name is Ravindra. He said, do you know what it means? The devotee said, it means the sun god, Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, no. He said, it means Krishna. He said, there is only one God. Well, look at the Ishopanishad. Agne Naya Supataraye Ashman. Begins like that. It's addressed to Agni. So when I read Ishopanishad in college, the translator translated it, "Oh Agni." I hear a man at the end. Here's a Upanishad, right? Ishavasham midam sarvam satyat kinchan. Throughout there, it's talking about worshipping, you know, Purna, like this verse here, Purna. That word is there, huh? Krishna's Purna. It's talking about the absolute truth. The one who controls and owns everything. And then at the end, when the man is preparing to offering prayers to the Lord, he says, "O Agni." So this translator says, oh, he's addressing a prayer to the demigod of fire. Why would somebody who be in the Ishopanishad, which is worshipping the absolute truth, suddenly at the end, and he's asking him to, how does it go, O Agne Naya Supataya Asyushai? I can't remember now the translation of that verse. Anybody remember? Yeah, I've forgotten it. He's asking him to consume all his sinful reactions. In the fire, you put the sacrifice and it's burned up. The fire is purifying. So to consume his sinful reactions. I can't remember the exact translation. So Prabhupada translates that, "O my Lord, powerful as the fire." So he understands that when the Ishopanishad says Agne Naya, addressed to Agni, it's not to the demigod, it's to Krishna, who's addressed with the name Agni, because he purifies the way fire purifies. And that's the correct understanding. So that's what he says here. That's the system that people may worship because they want different departmental material benedictions. They'll worship the demigods. But if they understand properly, they understand they're worshiping them as part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. Then they can make a mistake. They may think that Vishnu, that name, is another demigod. But Krishna makes it very, very clear in the Bhagavad Gita that the names of Vishnu are exceptional. It's not on the same level. Somebody hand me a Bhagavad Gita. He said, they're not on the same level. Krishna is not a demigod. The demigods are jivas that are appointed officials. But Krishna himself is the absolute truth, source of everything. So he's categorically different. So gradually they come to understand this. Then they can worship the different demigods, understanding that actually they're actually worshiping Krishna. And then they come to direct devotional service of Krishna. So in this way, the system of demigod worship, if it's done properly in the Vedic context, leads one to the worship of Krishna. Now, let me see here. So in this 19th chapter, you know, he says, this is the verse that Prabhupada quotes, that he's talking about the great souls who are engaged in devotional service because they know me. Bhuta Adim. Adi means the origin of Bhuta, of all manifestations, Avyayam, inexhaustible. Not a demigod. No demigod is the origin of all creation. No demigod is inexhaustible. They have borrowed powers. And then he describes what they do. Always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination, Jiddhaprata, bowing down before me. These great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. And then he says, Jnana Yajnena Chap Anye, others, Anye, others, there are certainly others. Here Prabhupada says, others meaning those who are not Mahatmas. Although here in this verse, Mahatmas, advanced devotees, worship only the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Others, however, who are all also sometimes called Mahatmas, worship the Lord as Ekad Vena Prithak Vena. That's from 9:15. He said, others who engage in the cultivation of knowledge, they also worship me, Ekad Vena Prithak Vena, in oneness, in multiplicity, duality, Bahuda in diversity, Vishvatamukam, and in the universal form. They worship the Supreme Lord as one without a second, diverse in many, and in the universal form. One without a second, here Prabhupada means that they worship themselves as God. They worship their own soul as identical with the Supreme Soul. There's a way of meditating on yourself as God called Hunger Nopasana. So they worship themselves as God. Diverse in many, they worship anything as God, demigods or anything else, really, when you come down to it. They think you can do that since it's all one, right? Anything will do. They worship that as God. Or in the universal form. So these are the various forms of impersonalists. Well, then Krishna says, the next verse after that, Krishna says, very interestingly, Aham kratur, aham yajna, swad aham, aham oshada, mantro aham, aham evajyam, aham agnir, aham hutam. Notice like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Eight times this word aham has been written. I am the kratu, the Vedic ritual. Aham yajna, I am the sacrifice. Swadaham, I am the swada, the offering. Aham oshadam, I am the herb, the plant. Mantra aham, these are all different things in the sacrifice. The kratu, the sacrifice itself, the swada, the oshada, the mantra. Aham evajyam. Ajam means the ghee. Aham agnya, I am the fire. Aham hutam, I am the offering. So it's talking about sacrifice. So in sacrifice, it is, Krishna says, it is myself. And then he continues, Pitaham, I am the father of this universe, the mother, the support, the grandsire. I am the object of knowledge, the purifier and the syllable Om. I am also the Rig, the Sama, and the Yajurveda. I am the goal, the sustainer, the master, the witness, the abode, the refuge, and the most dear friend. I am the creation and the annihilation, the basis of everything, the resting place, and the eternal seed, and so on. So Krishna very clearly states, you know, his unique position. It's a little hard to be. And then he says, you know, those who study the Vedas and drink the soma juice, seeking the heavenly planets, worship me indirectly. Purified of sinful reactions, they take birth on the pious heavenly planets of Indra, where they enjoy godly delights. When they have thus enjoyed vast heavenly sense pleasure and the results of their pious activities are exhausted, they return to the mortal planet again. Thus, those who seek sense enjoyment by adhering to the principles of the three Vedas achieve only repeated birth and death. Then he says very clearly, those who are devotees of other gods and who worship them with faith actually worship only me, but they do so in a wrong way. That's his statement. Avidhi purvakam. That's avidhi. Later on, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is talking about those who are asuras. He says, they perform yajna, avidhi purvakam. So he uses the same expression. They perform sacrifice, avidhi purvakam, in name only, just for show. So it's improper worship. So in this way, Krishna makes it very, very clear that he is to be is the goal of all these Vedic processes. Okay, any questions about this? Yeah.
Because it's from the subversive line that's bringing it back, you know, those who are going to worship
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not actually devil worship. Krishna is very clear exactly what it is. It's interesting, like in the Bible, you know, it simply says that, you know, you should worship God and God alone, and you should have no other gods besides Him. Right? It doesn't explain anything, doesn't tell you why, it just, you know. But Krishna ultimately says the same thing. But, you know, he gives a much more appeal to your intelligence to understand that if you worship other gods, you only achieve something temporary, and that it's actually the gods are there. The worship is sanctioned, but that those who worship other gods, he says, their minds are distorted by material desires. That's what he said, Ritagyan, their minds are the distorted knowledge. Alpamedasam. He says they have meager intelligence. Why is that? Because when you worship other gods, you only achieve flickering happiness. You go to some place, you can get some benediction, but it's temporary. Even if you go to, you know, Chandraloka or Indraloka, you can enjoy for so long, but then you come back down. So why should you do this? Why should you spend your effort and energy on something that's temporary? So Krishna is saying, don't. You should worship me and me alone. And since I'm the absolute truth and I include all these gods, don't think that your obligation to them will be unfulfilled. Because if you worship me, automatically they're also worshipped. So in this way, you know, he gives an appeal to, you know, your intelligence and your reason. Just like, you know, if you have a child that's not very intelligent, you just tell him not to do something. He can't understand why. He doesn't understand, but so you just lay down the law very heavy. And you just say, if you do this, you'll be punished. But if you have somebody that's more reasonable, you can explain why it's not a good idea. Don't accept candy from strangers. Well, a child's very young. You say, just don't do it. You know, if you do it, I'll punish you. But if it's older, you say, well, you know, sometimes there are people that kidnap little children, do nasty things. You know, you can give some explanation why the child can understand. So that's a more advanced platform. It's idolatrous to worship anything other than Krishna, then God is idolatry. And the Vedic system is so nicely arranged that even though people who worship the demigods, if they do it properly, will gradually come to worship Krishna. But the problem is that here, like when it's describing the system on Vartvarsha, there's no actual, it's not, it's not offensive to Krishna. But if you worship the demigods and you accept Krishna or Vishnu also on the same level, like impersonalists do, then it becomes offensive. It's not good for people either. They won't make any progress in that way because of them not properly following. You know, they just take some concocted system, you know, or adapt it to their own means. That's a different thing.
So to that extent, then it's like that. It's like when it really is on the same level, then it is money.
Yeah, sure.
See, so what I'm seeing is that due to lack of information, as you put it, that, you know, you can't tell if it's not very intelligent, so expectation. They have a blanket of coverage where, you know, everything's bad, everything's mine, like that. Because certain things can be seen rather than to give clarity in the situation. You know, and distinguish between demigod worship and offensive supreme personality. So the reason why I'm asking you to clarify this point is because I'm finding that with many Christians that I meet, that actually their views are so distorted from the truth, and that a lot of times I don't think it's based on prejudice. I think it's based on the fact that the scriptures or the teachers in the scriptures have such valid information.
Yeah, well, the lack of information is in many cases very deliberate, you know. In other words, they won't hear what you have to, you know, they won't listen to you. If they'll listen to you, that's another thing. But a lot of times they don't want to hear. Yeah, well, that's there. It's just put in a very simple way. Look, don't worship any other gods. You know, like when even in the Old Testament, you're supposed to worship, you know, the God of Israel and not Baal and Ishtar. But actually, it never says that Baal and Ishtar don't exist. That they're worshiping some imaginary beings. No, you're just not supposed to worship them. They're like on a lower level. You know. And then the idea came that they're diabolical. But why? You know, what they do, in essence they do, is they think that Krishna is also not God. That's their problem. They think that Krishna is not God. They think that that name or that personality is not the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, without ever finding out what we mean by Krishna, without ever reading the Bhagavad Gita, without ever, you know, they just know automatically in advance that Krishna is not the Supreme Personality of Godhead. No, that's demon worship. Those in the modes of goodness worship the demigods, but those in the modes of passion worship demons. It's worship of some greater being, but they're actually, you know, especially like people worship rock stars. I mean, they're definitely worshiping plain old. Well, that's even the mode of ignorance, because then you're getting into the Rakshasa category. You know, worshiping ghosts and, you know, things like that. You're getting down really low. It's in a sense it's perverted, because the tendency is always there to worship something higher. But what you conceive is the highest. I was reading somewhere that this rock star named Michael Jackson is being promoted as the greatest artist of all times. Not just, you know, greatest recording artist, greatest singer, but greatest artist. I mean, it's amazing. You see, I mean, like, there's so much, you know, like, apparently greater than, you know, Michelangelo, Shakespeare. He's the greatest artist of all times. So people's view, you know, is that actually that this is practically God, this guy, because of the little, you know, box that they're in. That's the way they see him. So everybody's worshiping what they think of as the greatest, but according to their modes of nature, who they think is great. Yeah? Diana, Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Yeah, they're into goddess worship. They're all Mayavadis. They don't really believe she exists. You know, because they're all like, I know these people. They're all, you know, have PhDs in religion, and they sit around in committee rooms and make these things up. And they think that they're all symbols, and that really, you know, the ultimate truth is a neuter it, you know, and so God can be, you can make God into a woman as well as a man, because it's actually, we make up our own gods, you know. And according to that philosophy, you know, homosexuals can, you know, decide that God is, you know, a drag queen. I mean, you know, they can, whatever is the greatest, you know. So actually, I mean, they don't, you know, you won't find these feminists who really believe that she's really there. You'll always find that underneath it all, they, you know, it's a symbol, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And they're worshiping, I don't know what. So I don't know where they go, you know. I don't know who they're going to, and I you know, it's very hard to know if they get anything out of it. It's all concocted in committee rooms, this stuff. Yeah, they're sex goddesses. Yeah. Well, yeah, goddess Aphrodite. Yeah, I guess there are people that worship, you know, God. Everybody's, you know, it's just like they worship anything as God. You know, you can do it. I mean, in the Mayavadi theory, you know, basically you could, in principle.